Meet the bed by Thuma, the perfect platform bed frame. Thoughtfully handcrafted from upcycled wood, the bed is strong, backed by a lifetime warranty, and ships directly to your door. Assembly takes 5 minutes, no tools needed. To get $25 towards the bed, go to Thuma.co. That's Thuma.co to receive $25 off your purchase of the bed. Shop the bed at Thuma.co.
Okay, Earth 101 is Gary, it's Lisa. Our special guest this morning, Zorro the drummer.
So good to be here.
Yeah, ZorroTheDrummer.com. That's Zorro with one R. Is that why you did that? You dropped the R so they wouldn't think you were the Zorro?
They wouldn't think I'm the other Zorro. My mother suggested that. She goes, you should call yourself Zorro because you're like the real Zorro, because the real Zorro had always a heart for the underdog. He always fought for the commoner, the person that was marginalized. So she said, you're like the real Zorro, but you should just use one R.
Now, Zorro and I have known each other for a long time.
A long time.
But I wanted you to come in because you have such an amazing life story, and you put it together in this book called Maria's Scarf. And Maria's is your mom.
Yes.
And tell us, what is the significance of the scarf?
The scarf. Well, my mother was always very elegant. She was from Mexico City, like you said earlier. She wanted to be an actress, so she always wore these scarves and always looked really cool. And when I was, she was my only figure growing up. I didn't have a father. I didn't have grandparents. I didn't have uncles, aunts,
right,
cousins. It was her. So she was it. And I used to say, Mama, you look beautiful in your scarves. Like, you look like a movie star. Like, I want to look like you. And so I was, for the second grade pictures the night before, I asked her if I could wear her scarf. And she says, no, mijo, you can't wear my scarf. The kids will beat you up, man. This is not Mexico. This is the United States. They don't wear scarves in the United States. And I'm like, but Mama, you look cool. I want to wear your scarf. And I had to think of something. I was like, well, Elvis Presley wears scarves, and Tom Jones wears scarves.
Right.
And so she finally relented and knelt down and tied her silk scarf around my neck, and then she whispered, she goes, one day, my son, you will do something amazing. She said, you'll do something phantasmical with your life. That was the word she used, phantasmical.
Wow.
And it was sort of like a prophetic utterance over me. She decreed something, and something phantasmal eventually happened.
It did happen.
You're wearing a scarf, well, an ascot, if you will.
Well, it's actually a scarf. I'm still, so I wear scarves.
But you have it, it wears like an ascot,
yeah,
the way you're wearing,
yeah,
it.
Totally.
Yeah, totally.
And I still wear them this day in honor of her. So it's to keep her memory alive. And the there's more about the scarf throughout the whole book. It's
right.
Very beautiful, and I won't give the ending away, but it's, yeah, it'll make you cry. It's very powerful.
The whole book is very emotional. By the way, Alex Van Halen endorsed your book.
It's amazing. You know?
Another drummer.
So
right.
Did Kathy Lee Gifford.
Yeah.
Talk about the other side.
Yeah, but there's a lot of great endorsements of this book. And people, and I wrote you one after
you
read it.
You did, yeah. Yeah. And I remember you texting me, you were like, man, this book was amazing. I couldn't put it down, and it inspired me. And I mean, I think what people will get out of the book is four words. It's heartwarming, it's heartbreaking, it's utterly hilarious,
yeah,
but it ends hopeful, and you will leave inspired. You will be touched emotionally,
yeah.
But you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll feel every emotion under the sun, but you'll be moved and you'll be inspired.
Let's talk about your mom again here,
yeah,
because you know we're asking this morning, who would play your mother in the movie of your life? I think there's going to be a movie made of this book because it's too powerful, it's too good, it's too timely for a movie not to be made. But your mother came here from Mexico wanting to be a movie star.
Yeah.
And she met some American guys.
Yeah, some wrong guys. Yeah.
Some wrong guys.
Yeah.
Your dad was a guy named Donnelly.
Yeah.
So so your dad was Irish, right?
He was Irish, yeah.
Yeah.
And ironically, he was a drummer. And
really?
But he left me when I was like 6 months old. And there's a picture in the book that I still have. It's like a prophetic picture because at 18 months, I've got this picture. I'm in a stroller, and beneath my infant feet are his bongos.
Really?
The only thing he accidentally left me was a set of his bongos.
Did you ever see him again?
I met him for the first time in my life, and I tell that story in the book. He avoided me as my entire life, and I sent letters when I was a kid over and over, and he never responded. I never talked to him, but I tracked him down, and at 18 or 17, and the first night I met him, he came to my high school graduation.
Wow.
That's the first night I met him. So it was, that story's a movie right there, that chapter.
Just that chapter is a movie,
It's crazy.
So
who would play your mom?
Selma Hayek.
There you go.
Oh, there you go.
Now we're talking.
That's who I've always imagined playing her, because Selma and her are both from Mexico City. They both came from aristocratic families. They were both small and petite. They were both beautiful, and they both love acting. Selma made it. My mother didn't. But Selma would get this person. Selma would. This would be an Oscar-winning role for Selma, playing my mother.
You need to get this book to her.
We're going to.
Yeah. So here's the thing. So you wind up, she winds up with seven kids.
Yeah, with no fathers.
And no fathers, living in Compton.
Yep.
You guys were so poor, and this is part of the book that really hit me. You would have just enough money to take the bus to the beach.
Yeah.
But then you had no money to get home. So she would go around the parking lot at the beach asking people if they would give you a ride back home.
That's how we got around.
Oh, my God.
And it wouldn't always be one driver. So sometimes a driver would take us to a certain place and drop us off, and then she'd have to do the routine all over again and find somebody else to give us a ride. And you got all these kids, and, you know, it's not the safest thing in the world, but that's how we got around. I mean, like, and we moved from apartment to apartment, sometimes with my red radio flyer wagon, where we would put the furniture and stack it a certain way, and you could move that thing two miles down the road.
Because
we didn't have a U-Haul.
Yeah. You didn't have much to move.
No.
So, is she still with us?
No. She passed away 20 years ago.
Oh.
So the book will be almost the 20th anniversary since she passed away.
Yeah. The book is called Maria's Scarf. If you're just tuning in, Zorro the drummer is with us, acknowledged as one of the best drummers in the world. And you've written books about drumming.
But sure.
This time it's about your mom. It's called Maria's Scarf. And so flashing forward.
Yeah.
Your mom moved you guys up to Oregon. That's a whole other story. But I want to get to the part where you come back to L.A. and you decide you're going to go to Beverly Hills High School.
Right.
But even though you weren't a student.
So what happened was I was 17. I had just graduated high school up in Eugene, Oregon. So I was a high school graduate, but I came down to L.A. to make it with a band that was going to score a gig at Disneyland. Well, we auditioned, and they didn't get the gig, and so I wound up in Anaheim, and I didn't know what to do. The band fell apart, and I called my mother. I said, Mama, I think I'm going to have to come back home to Eugene and regroup because it didn't work out. And she goes, no, don't come back, mijo. She goes, if you come back, you'll never make it. You've got to find a way to stay in L.A. because you have the talent, but if you come back here, there's nothing. Mm. So I didn't really know what to do. I'm 17, and my sister is a model. She is renting an apartment with a girlfriend in Beverly Hills, and she says, well, why don't you come over here for a couple of weeks and see what you can make happen? So I didn't really know what to do, and so I decided I was going to go to Beverly Hills High. I had a practice pad, my drumsticks, a Ghetto Blaster boombox. I was cranking Earth, Wind, and Fire. I was wearing a yellow silk shirt, silk pants. I looked like Big Bird on the lawn. You couldn't have missed me. And I said, I'm just going to play with my pad. And if there's any young musicians here, they'll probably come up and talk to me.
I know who was there.
And that's exactly what happened.
Well, first off, you met Barry Gordy's kids,
yes,
right?
Yes. So the first kid who came up to me, it was Kennedy Gordy, and he later called himself Rockwell. And he was like, are you new here? And I kind of really didn't know what to say because I'm not really a student, but I was just like, yeah.
We had a lot of those kids coming up to our school.
Yeah, Lisa
school.
Went to
I
Beverly
went to
Hills.
Beverly Hills High.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. I did. Yeah.
So, Zorro the Drummer and ZorroTheDrummer.com with one R, ZorroTheDrummer.com. So did you wound up at Barry Gordy, who founded Motown, you wound up at his house with his kids hanging out. Michael Jackson was there?
So one day I'm up. This is all within a couple weeks of sitting on the lawn.
Oh, my God.
Right? I'm sitting on the lawn, and then we become friends, and he takes me up to his house in Bel Air, and we're driving through the hills. I'm going, who are these people? Like, whoever they are, they're rich, because we keep going higher and higher in the mountain. And then we get there, and it's like the Bat Cave, you know, like the gate that closes and is shrouded. And then he introduces me to his father, and I'm like, that's your dad, like Barry Gordy. That's Motown was like my record label as a kid. I bought all those 45s. 2 weeks later, I'm at the house playing pinball machines in the front room because he's the only kid I know who's got an arcade that you don't have to put quarters in.
Right.
And I'm playing pinballs, and I hear the doorbell ring, and nobody's there, and I decide to go answer it. I saw these two Rolls Royces pulling up. I go and open up the big, huge oak door. And lo and behold, I'm staring at Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. They were like my favorite group.
Oh, yeah. So the very first session that you played on as a drummer, the big session, was a song called Somebody's Watching Me, and with your friend Kennedy Gordy, who called himself Rockwell, and Michael Jackson singing, Somebody's Watching Me.
Yeah. And the funniest thing about that song is Kennedy was first pitching it to Lenny Kravitz to tell Lenny to do it. Lenny wasn't even an artist then. He was just a young kid. He goes, you should do my song. And then Lenny was like, no, you should do it. And then Kennedy did that sort of English voice thing, you know, and then he enlisted Michael to sing on it. But this, we were all kind of kids, really. We were just super duper young.
And this is one of the iconic songs of that decade.
Totally.
Yeah.
And he asked Michael to sing background on it because, you know, his dad was Berry Gordy.
Yeah.
And Michael did, but that's the hook that everyone knows.
So how did you get with Lenny finally? Didn't you help him get a record deal?
No. So with Lenny, Lenny was the second kid who came up to me on the lawn at Beverly Hills High.
Right.
And then, so basically I told those guys I was a new student. So I just kept showing up every day.
Oh, God.
Every day. And nobody ever asked.
Security. And the two security guards, Mr. Mann, didn't say anything to you or Andy? Neither
nothing,
of them?
Because they kept seeing me all the time.
Oh,
they just figured he belonged there.
And then what I would do is during class, I would go into the library and hang out in the library. And then when the class was over, I'd walk in the hallway. So they just started. And what other 17-year-old kid is just going to walk in there and pretend like I never intended to do that? It's just in order to keep hanging out with my buddies, I had to keep going there, and I was graduated already, so I was free, so I got to relive my senior year without actually doing any work.
It's too much, man. Wouldn't you go like sit in the library while the kids were in class?
I would have my Walkman, you know, like, and listen to
that music. Library was a great library.
It was beautiful.
It was a fantastic library.
So then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but I know it takes a while, but Lenny Kravitz, did that happen after the New Edition?
Yes. So
you were New Edition, Bobby Brown in the New Edition.
Then Lenny. So what happened was in 85, Lenny had become an advocate for me from the minute I met him at Beverly Hills High when he was a year and a half younger than me.
Right.
He loved me. He wanted me at the school every day. When he finally found out I wasn't a student there, he said, just keep coming. I'll just tell everyone you're my cousin and you moved here from New York. And, you know, like he wanted me there every day. And we would drive around in my beat up old Omega and go to Golden Bird Fried Chicken and do the whole and famous cookies. But Lenny in 85 recommended me for the New Edition. They were looking for a drummer and a guitar player.
Okay.
He auditioned on guitar. I auditioned on drums. I got the gig. He didn't get the gig. And so he had to watch me get famous for like 4 years.
He slept on the couch in my cousin's office at A&M Records.
Well, really?
That sounds like him.
Yeah. That is how he got his record deal.
Yeah, well, he was cruising around everywhere. But so he recommends me for the gig. So here's what's funny. So I invite him to come and see me at Universal Amphitheater because he got me the gig. And that's where he meets Lisa Bonet backstage at my gig.
Oh,
so
my God.
He wouldn't have Zoe and I wouldn't have my career without each other.
Isn't that fantastic?
Our lives were completely intertwined.
And by the way, just another shot for you. Didn't you introduce Whitney Houston to Bobby Brown?
I did. In 1989 at the Soul Train Awards.
We'll forgive you for that.
Yeah, you're forgiven.
Well,
thank you. Along with many other things. But,
right.
Yeah, so I've been instrumental in some certain people connecting in Hollywood that were very big.
Listen, this book is full of these stories, and it goes from poverty and an immigrant who came here with dreams, and this dream came true in you, Maria Scarfe.
Well, what's cool is I told my brother, Bobby, I said, you know, April 30th, when the book comes out, I said, we're going to make Mama famous. She's going to finally be famous but for something more important, the office of motherhood, because mothers are the unsung heroes of the world. They're the ones that do all the heavy lifting, all the emotional caring, all the nurturing of souls, all the fostering of dreams, and they never get credit, and they're never written about because everybody just writes about celebrities. But this is a book that every mother will read, and they will weep, and they will cry, and they will be inspired not to give up. Because my mother was like any other mother listening. You always think you're doing it wrong, and you never think your kids are going to turn out right because you're overwhelmed. But the truth is, my mother's love was irrepressible, and her love conquered everything.
Fantastic.
And everyone who's listening, your love will conquer everything. Your love is what will see your kids through to the end, because it's a messy gig. Nobody does it perfect. We're learning as we go.
Right.
But I wanted to honor her memory, and inspire people that in the face of adverse circumstances to never give up, to never count yourself out.
Let me give the website, ZorroTheDrummer.com. That is ZorroTheDrummer.com, and it's Zorro with one R. Check it out and get this book for your mom. It is fantastic. Maria Scarfe. Zorro, love you, man.
Love you, man. Thanks for having me.
You got it.